Session number 13265, reel number 27.
Mr. Marsden, reel 27.
Yes. Oh, I'd just been reminded of the a Christmas dinner at Linton-on-Ouse when I suppose it was I, Lord Chapman, the stated commander, had gone to the trouble of organising turkey. Enough turkey for every airman to have a helping of turkey with his Christmas dinner. As you probably know, in the services, or in the RAF at any rate, on Christmas Day, it's the custom for the officers to take part in, supposedly in serving and so on, but at any rate, the station commander goes round the dining hall and so on. And on this occasion, he came round with his entourage, acting the part of the orderly officer, when, of course, the orderly officer draws the attention of everybody in the place to himself and asks any complaints. And, of course, Ive Lord Chapman, quite properly, was expecting congratulations. And I stood up and said, "Yes, sir." And I was, it was just like Hollywood Twist asking for more with the Beadle present. And what's the complaint? And I said, I'm sorry to have to make a complaint, sir, but this turkey is inedible. "What do you mean, inedible?" I said, "Well, inedible." I said, "I can't even cut it with my knife." And I'm afraid it rather upset our Lord Chapman's Christmas. And they all shot into the kitchen rather rapidly, and that was the last we heard of it. But I don't know whether the cooks had cocked up the turkey, or whether it was the turkey that was made of rubber in the first place anyway. By their disasters ye shall remember them. Back to the islands anyway. There's one more little item of note. After we'd been on Vela some time, I had to order some more drums of caustic soda for our purifiers, and they were brought up to us, I suppose, from Guadalcanal, from Lunga, in an LCT, and the weather was a bit roughish, I suppose, and she was shipping water and so on, and the whole lot got fairly wet, and apparently one of the crew decided that he wanted to know what was in these drums. This was a not unusual practice of sailors, because they liked to open drums and barrels and tubs in case there was anything in there from which they might themselves profit personally. So this character, with all the water sloshing about in the LCT, goes down with a screwdriver, forces the clips off, and forced the lid of this drum open. Just as the ship heaved or pitched or something else, and must have been punctured, because the sea water had got into it, and the contents slopped up into the air, and he got a faceful, and it blinded him. And the result of this was that when we went down to the beach to collect our stuff, they were treating us as though this incident was all our fault. They, I mean the crew of the LCT. When, of course, the bloke who'd opened the drum had done it himself, bought and paid for. "Take what you want," says God, "take it and pay for it." Not very nice for him, but he should have kept his neb out. That pretty well covers our time up on Vela. I think there's not much else of any import. Oh yes, there was the feint attack on Choiseul by the American Marine Battalion. The Americans were going to make another landing on Bougainville, and so it was decided to make a feint attack on Choiseul to draw off some of the Japanese troops. So they were sent up across to Choiseul, and I don't know whether the news of the landing had leaked or whatever, but they've got a pretty hot reception and they took very heavy casualties. In round about 1982, I was on holiday in Tunisia, and there was a chap in our party of whom I said to Margaret, to my wife, I said, you know, that chap was US Navy or Marines, I'm certain. And she said, how do you know? I said, well, I don't know. How do you know? I said, I'm just sure. He was American. So I spoke him one day and he said, yes, he was Marines. And I said, where were you? And he said, Pacific. I said, oh, yes. Where? He said, nowhere you've ever heard of. I said, well, how do you know that? Well, he said, I've never met anybody who's ever heard of the place. He said, you won't have heard of it. I said, oh, where were you? I said, when were you there then? Oh, he said, October, November, 43. I said, oh. I said, you were on Vella Lavella, weren't you? He literally fell back, totally staggered. He said, how did you know that? I said, well, because the only Marines who were doing anything in the Pacific at that time were on Vella Lavella. I said, you went up to Choiseul on that operation. I said, and I saw you all come back. And a fair old mess you were, too. And, yes, and I was the first chap he'd ever met since the war who'd even heard of Vella. Which, you know, goes to show how what you think is quite a big effort is actually a very small one. You know, for all the hundreds of people who were on the island, it really was a very small bit of the war. And indirectly, he said, taking part in that operation had saved his life, because as a result of the casualties their battalion took, the battalion eventually went back to the States to recuperate, and whilst he was there he got into a fight in a bar in San Francisco and broke his wrist, as a result of which he missed the draft and didn't get landed on Okinawa. And he wasn't at all displeased about breaking his wrist, not the least bit, because it probably saved his neck. Just the way these odd way these things work out. Anyway, we saw the majority of these chaps come back, and whilst they were all riding, there were an awful lot of them on Jeep ambulances. And for anyone who hasn't seen Jeep ambulances and the front line, these were rigged with outriggers, rather like the helicopters in MASH, but the outriggers with the stretchers on were two-tier, so that you had four stretchers hung on the outside and then four more stretchers on the inside, so each Jeep is carrying an orderly and eight men. And the sights ranged from moderate wounds. There's no such thing as a slight wound in the islands in those days, because every slight wound, as I said about the tropical sores I got, rapidly becomes a nasty. And so it ranged from stuff of that order, where fairly ordinary bandaging coped, to chaps who literally looked like the invisible man in the films when he bandaged himself up so that people could see him. And the smell that wafted off these chaps as they went past was fairly horrific. There must have been a fair few cases of gangrene. Well, and the look in the eyes of a lot of them, a curious deadness, a blankness. These chaps had seen the elephant and we hadn't, and they didn't want to know us. I don't think they could even see us. And after watching this train of jeeps go past for a few seconds, I suppose I felt ashamed at the time, but we turned our backs and went back onto the plant and looked away. We just couldn't bear to watch them. These fellows had all been right up to the sharp edge and got their lumps, and we were getting it pretty soft. It makes you feel somewhat ashamed, There's nothing you could have done about it, because it wasn't your job. It was no part of what you ought to be doing. But you still feel ashamed because they've been taking your lumps. That about wraps that up, I think. And so come the day we clamber aboard a Scats or Nats C-47, and we fly back to Henderson Field on Guadalcanal. No Hotel de Gink this time. This time we're on the way back, so we queue up and line up outside the mess halls with the rest of the troops, carefully keeping our helmets on, those of us who've got them. I'd kept mine, but I think one or two of our Kiwis had traded their helmets with the Americans, because there were one or two, Joe Grenone, for instance, preferred our tin hat to the American Army helmet, because that was the hat he'd been used to in the services from way back when, and he, for some reason, preferred it to the new American helmet. Certainly it was lighter, although it didn't have the advantages and conveniences of the American helmet, which was, as you know, a two-part device. You take the lining out, and the outer helmet can be used as a wash basin or whatever, and you can have a bath standing over it, swab yourself down. Anyway, that's what he fancied, so I think he'd done a trade either with Mac McCauley or Neil Carbon. The idea of wearing a steel helmet when you're standing in queue at the mess hall is that you're standing under extremely tall coconut palms, at that time you were on Henderson Field, and coconut palms are apt to shed coconuts with fairly reckless abandon, and there's no warning, you get no sound. And if you're under one in the right place and a coconut comes down, hits you on your head, you're dead. I saw one chap get his shoulder smashed, and that was it as far as he was concerned. He was away into the hospital and probably be sent back. Although by that time there were women nurses on the canal, and it was all becoming very civilised and orderly by this time. So once again we have the routine of reporting to traffic control or whatever they called it every day to see if we can get a flight out, and we're not going back by sea this time, of course. We came up by sea because we were travelling with the gear. So what we have to do now, we find, is to get a flight out to Espiritu Santo in the New Hebrides, where we can pick a flight up there with the New Zealand Air Force to get back to God's own country. So we have a fairly unpleasant several days on Henderson, killing time by mooching around looking at wrecked Japanese aeroplanes and walking down to see the site of Maggot Beach, which by now is not nearly so bad. It had been the site of an attempted Japanese landing after the Marines went in, and they'd been met by a chap in a bulldozer who'd swept down the beach as they'd landed and just bulldozed them into the beach, the blade just high enough to protect him from most of the stuff that was flying. And when they'd done, the beach was covered with dead bodies. They just dozed the sand over them, but the flies had got in at the same time, and I gather that at one time it had literally been heaving with maggots, hence Maggot Beach. So we saw the usual battlefield sights, and we wandered around into the bush just a little, but not very much, because we'd learned what the bush was like on Vela. Backtracking, there was from near where our base was, there was a path into the bush on Vela, which went across the hills onto the far side, We were told it was about 9 miles long. There was a telephone line along this path to a sort of coast watcher's posse on the far side. And somebody walked that path once a week to check the telephone cable. And we were told that 9 miles was generally reckoned to take about 3 days to walk, to cover. What with checking the cable and slashing away at the rapidly ingrowing jungle all the time, the bush. Real jungle is very different from the pictures of tropical forests that are commonly seen. And so, as I say, we were not about to go heading off into bush just to look for battlefield souvenirs. In any case, we all of us by now had a healthy respect for the remains of battlefields, and we didn't want to tread anything that might go bang in the night. Well, we got a flight to Espiritu Santo, and there, I don't know, I think we were tired and so on, but I had no canes, there was nothing growing round about which we could cut to make canes to hold up our mozzie nets, as a result of which I tried to sleep with the mozzie net draped over me instead of being properly set up. Our RAF mosquito nets were about 5 or 6 feet high, so that you could almost stand up on your cot inside one. There was plenty of room in them, and they were so attractive that one or two of the Americans had wanted to trade with us before we left Vela, and I'd traded mine with Joe Granone and come away with an American one. I'm not even sure that the American ones had been impregnated with chemical to repel mosquitoes, as ours were. Anyway, I tried sleeping with this thing draped over me. Next morning when I woke up, my two hands looked more like bunches of bananas than hands. They were swollen and fat. My fingers were about heading on for being twice the thickness that they are now, you know. Quite painful and itching like crazy and sore as blazer. I could hardly handle my irons when I went to breakfast, and I suspect that that was when I got a slight malarial infection, which has shown up on 3 or 4 occasions in the 40 odd years since. Bad enough when they brew up, but not very often. Well, so we hang about on Espiritu Santo, and here the difference between the amount of materiel available to the American forces and the New Zealand or Commonwealth forces showed up enormously. It was like travelling from a country town to a village slum. By comparison, they hadn't the equipment to grade roads and surface roads with coral and things of that order. Everything was distinctly there was an impermanence about the whole place compared with Henderson Field. Everywhere you tramped, you tramped in mud. You have to be aware that at this time of year, I don't know if it carries the whole year round, but we were up there from late Septemberish into the islands from late September through into January, and the rains occurred like clockwork every day at about either 20 minutes to or 10 minutes to 1, I can't remember, but it was on the dot, say 10 minutes to 1, the sky would open just as though somebody had slid a shutter back, and the most ginormous rain would come belting down for about half an hour. And every day at the same time, within a minute or two, and for the same period of time, during this period we got these slashing rains. That's not to say we didn't get any at night or any other time, but that was, as it were, standard issue. midday every day, you'd see folks making sure they got under cover around about that time and just waiting for the heavens to open. Put a bucket of water outside, you'd have a bucket of clean rainwater in before the rains had finished. Oh, and whilst I'm referring to that, I'll have to hop back a bit to one item I've missed. When we had the plant running on the island, one day I decided that I'd stick a bucket of water under the exhaust pipe for the nitrogen waste gas from the separator in order to make a bucket of cold water to get us a drink of cold water. So I drew off a bucket of water from the canvas sacks into which our water was delivered. You've seen, you know this type of thing, do you?
Yes.
A hanging sack with a tap on, which breathes wet and you get evaporation to keep it cool. Well, it didn't really get the water very cool, and after a while you get a gonky taste from it anyway. So I drew this bucket off, and bucket of water, stuck it under the nitrogen waste and left it for 20 minutes or so to thoroughly chill off, because the nitrogen waste, as it comes out, is a fair old blast. It's, I don't know how many hundreds of cubic feet an hour, but there's a fair lot of it. I mean, if you consider the throughput of the air going through the compressors. And went and collected it, got a cup and had a drink, and was amazed to find that the chlorination taste had all gone. It was like drinking fresh, cold spring water. Ah. So from then on, of course, we used this technique to deal with our water for making coffee and tea, so that we no longer had chlorinated coffee or chlorinated tea. And whilst we didn't say anything about it specifically, the word seemed to flash around the island. And it wasn't very long before we had bods coming from all over the place, in jeeps and one thing or another, bringing buckets of water to stand under our nitrogen exhaust. For which, of course, our bods immediately decided that this would be sensible to charge a price. If we're going to take the chlorine out of their water for them, what are they going to do for us? So there was all sorts of trading and finagling going on over this business of supplying dechlorinated water. It's one of those daft little things. Anyway, eventually we get allotted to a flight back to New Zealand from Espirito. It's a Lockheed Lodestar. Clamber aboard, and who do I find aboard but the navigator is a PO, pilot officer, whom I had known as a sergeant at Hamilton when he'd been, for some reason or other, rooker here, or both, in the sergeant's mess there. And he's now commissioned. I've forgotten his name. And he's flying on this trip, not as the actual navigator. He's got a Sprog navigator with him, and he's flying as a kind of checkout on this bod. So we fly from Espirito Santo in the New Hebrides down to Norfolk Island, and we land there at about 11:45 or so. Now, once on the way home, of course, Mac McCauley and Neil Carvin and t'other lad and myself, we're anxious to get on, so we don't understand what all this hanging about is on Norfolk Island, because the air crew are in no hurry to get going. So anyway, we're the cargo, we just have to bear with it. So we're put into the back of a truck, and we're trundled off across the island for dinner to a private house where the folks, the civilians there, I suppose, had a kind of contract to provide meals for people in transit. And we got a spanking good old-fashioned British dinner. You know, Yorkshire pudding and beef and... and marvellously too, I should think, the only glass of beer I've ever had, a glass of bitter beer, which was, I would say, would be better than Mansfield Brewery, which produced a drink long past and long regretted. I don't think there's any bitter beer produced like it in this country today. An absolute marvellous home brew, but strong. So that after I'd had two half glasses, I knew I'd had enough, and I wasn't about to risk any more. And we found out that every family on Norfolk Island brewed its own beer. They were fiercely competitive as to quality. The Australian customs, who I think Norfolk was either a British-Australian condominium or it was under Australian authority, Australian customs were a real shower of wowsers, and they were doing the damnedest to stop home brew on the island and make the islanders import it from the mainland. You know, under the normal customs regulations such as we have today in this country with regard to brewing things or making wines and spirits. And so they were Australian customs doing everything they could to stop yeast and other supplies being smuggled to the island for beer making. And we were shown a pile of beer bottles, again these brown imperial quartz. There was a stack of beer bottles outside the corrugated iron chapel, which was in fact bigger than the chapel itself. I think the biggest stack of beer bottles I've ever seen in my life. And we were told that this was communal property. When any family had emptied bottles from its last brewing, they were all washed out and taken to this stack to be available for anyone else who needed the next lot for their next brew, so that the bottles were constantly travelling. And there had been an avenue of Norfolk pines across the island, and I don't know when they were planted, but there's historical note of it. These had been cut down to give clearance on the runway, which was I've been trying to remember whether the runway on Norfolk Island at this date was grass or concrete. I can't remember, or whatever, or hard. Can't remember at all. But you could see the stumps of this great stand of Norfolk pines, which had been cleared to give way to it, and there was considerable regret on the part of the islanders, because apparently these trees had been of the order of 80-100 foot, magnificent trees, and all gone. And I don't think they've been replaced since, now that Norfolk Island has become a kind of Wild West come tourist town. We were taking a tour of the island. It's only about 8 miles by five, and the chap of the house took us in the truck and proudly showed us all the sights. One of the major sights was the cliff over which all the trash was dumped. It's curious how places like this have their own ideas of places, the kind of things you ought to see. Anyway, we got